All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's Parliamentary Library Lecture and a very warm welcome to our speaker today, Anthony Green. The Black Arts of Elections and Understanding the Interplay of Voters, Voter Intentions, Voting Systems is dear to the heart of many in this building, and there's probably a few people in Australia better qualified to speak on the subject than Anthony Green. He's such a familiar figure that he needs very little introduction, I think, but I'll give a very little introduction anyway. He's the ABC's election analyst. He's responsible for the contents of the ABC's election website and the ABC's Election Night's Results Service. He's also a popular blogger on electoral matters. He's worked for the ABC since 1989 and has worked in that time on over 50 federal, state and territory elections. I was also interested to read when I was preparing these notes that Anthony designed the ABC's election night computer system. So it's not just the front of house stuff, but the spooky technical stuff that goes on underneath it. I was very impressed.
Terrifies people.
Yeah. I don't do numbers. His analysis today, I think, is particularly interesting in the context of the West Australia Senate elections that we've had, and of course we have a new Senate about to start next week. So Anthony will speak for about half an hour and then we'll have some time for questions. So I'd invite you to join me in welcoming Anthony Green.
Just arrange my props here. It's a great pleasure to be here. This is a wonderful designed room with a pillar in the middle of the room. So I'll try not to ignore you over here. What I was asked to talk about was, with Senate reform, of course, being a big topic in politics at the moment, was to talk about what's been proposed by the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters, and to draw on, it has drawn on some ideas in New South Wales, and I've decided to draw on some research I've done on New South Wales Legislative Council ballot papers, which is useful as a tool to try and model how the new Senate system might work. I presume everyone can hear me. Everyone can hear me? Good, all right. So, that's how we go. I'll just start off by describing the existing Senate system, which you're probably all familiar with. It's got a large ballot paper divided in the top third by a big black line. You have the option of voting above the line with a single one, but which means that you adopt a party's preference ticket for every candidate on the ballot paper. Or if you vote below the line for candidates, you have to vote for every candidate on the ballot paper. So you've got that choice between the two systems. What's been proposed is to keep the existing ballot paper, still divided above and below the line. You can vote for parties above the line, vote for candidates below the line. However, the thing that you can't see on the ballot paper, which is those group ticket votes of preferences, the proposal is to abolish them. So that if you vote with a single one above the line, that one would only be for the candidates of that party you've chosen. The ticket would have no automatic preferences for anyone else on the ballot paper. It would be that party alone. However, you could optionally give your own preferences above the line. You could vote one Labor, two Green, one Christian Democrat, two Liberal. You could do that sort of thing above the line, and that would be implied then upon the candidates on the ballot paper. Or if you don't want to vote for parties above the line, you can vote below the line, but the preferences become entirely optional. I think the proposal is for six preferences below the line, but there would be a relatively liberal interpretation of the formality rules on that. So basically, if you vote for one party below the line, your vote would roughly be formal. So it's a much simpler system, and it gets rid of all the preference deals. The origins of the new system is proposed by the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters. It's developed in response to the Senate election last year, which many of you, particularly those who live outside of the ACT, would remember. Anybody who lived in Queen Bianne and got that ballot paper, which was 1 metre long with 110 candidates in 45 columns in 6-point type, you would well remember that ballot paper. The system that's been proposed is very similar to that used in the New South Wales Legislative Council since 2003. And the key feature is this introduction of optional preferential voting, which has knock-on consequences for a number of aspects with the way the system works. The implications, I'll run through these implications in general before going to the New South Wales examples precisely. It will advantage parties with significant first preference votes and disadvantage parties that rely on preferences to get elected. It will mean that parties will no longer be able to control their preferences, but parties will be able to influence preferences by recommending it on how-to-vote cards. And it will disadvantage parties that do not actively campaign for votes and do not actively campaign to direct preferences. So if someone just puts their name on the ballot paper and nobody knows who they are, then they are unlikely to get many votes and they certainly won't be able to control their preferences as they do under the current system. Now, a comparison which needs to be made, because the system, if it's adopted like New South Wales, there are differences between the two systems. In the Senate, we'd only be electing six senators per state, or two in the ACT, where in the New South Wales Upper House, you're electing 21 members at large. The quota would be 14.29 in the Senate. It's only 4.5 in New South Wales. The New South Wales votes quota for federally, the Senate, is 625,000, roughly. At the New South Wales election, it's 185,000. And the minimum preferences for the Senate would be six, where for constitutional reasons in New South Wales, there are 15. Actually, now, before I go on to that, I'll do my, what I call my ballot paper porn segment. The reason that New South Wales reformed its system was the famous 1999 ballot paper. Now, I'll step aside for this, for those who haven't seen it before. This is the famous tablecloth with 81 columns and 264 candidates. This was an extraordinary rule that went on to that election, which I'll provide some more details on later. And they introduced the new system, which is what I'll be describing here today. The only problem was, they ended up with this ballot paper, which I've always called a mutant lotto form. And just as a sidetrack before I go into this, that ballot paper in the New South Wales Upper House is actually a good warning to anybody who ever tries to entrench too much details in a constitution. New South Wales didn't elect their Upper House until 1978. That was the first popular election for the Upper House. And the Labor Party at the time was determined it would be proportional representation, it would be optional preferential voting to avoid the giant ballot paper that occurred in the 1974 Senate election. And they basically put optional preferential voting into the Constitution, along with the entire Senate counting system of the day, which included random sampling. And that was entrenched. And the difficulty ever since then is if you wanted to actually change the Senate, the Upper House, substantially, you need a referendum to do it. So when they changed the counting system, they were still stuck with this provision in the Constitution that said you had to have 15 preferences, which is why that ballot paper came about, because it meant that if they got rid of the ticket voting above the line, and a vote for above the line was only for that party, they had to enforce a party to stand 15 candidates, so it met the minimum number of preferences required by the Constitution. So another sideline of that is because they entrenched random sampling as part of the counting procedure, New South Wales now uses a computer to count the votes, like every other upper house in the country. But instead of using the computer to do the count accurately, they use the computer to do the random sampling accurately, which means if they ever hit the button to count the votes again, they can get a different result. That's a long story, and nobody wants to duplicate what happened in New South Wales. Anyway, I'll move on to some examples. This sets out what happened. New South Wales has elected 29, and I presume at the back you won't be able to read this, so I'll run through it carefully. Down the groups column there is the number of columns on the ballot paper. At the first election for 21 in 1995, there were 28 groups. When someone was elected from 1.3% of the vote by preference, this preferencing method, there were suddenly 81 columns over three groups, which was that ballot paper I showed you. After that, they then introduced a new system, tightened up the rules on the regulation of the parties, and since then we've had 16, 20, and 17 groups, so substantially smaller groups. But as I said, this problem with the number of candidates resulted in the candidates being 99 in 1995, 264 in 1999. But despite the cut in the number of groups, the candidates have gone up to 284, 333, and 311 since. So we would not have that final column of candidate numbers under the Senate system because there wouldn't be this requirement to stand so many candidates. But that's a little consequence that's come of New South Wales' system. The members elected have been 21 at each election, and I've got the numbers elected here for each of the parties. And I'll deal with the last column first. Under the old system in 95 and 99, there were four minor parties elected in 95, six in 1999, but only two out of the elections since. And each of those two has been one Christian Democrat and one Shooters Party representative. The Greens' representation has gone up, and since the introduction of the new system, There's been two extra major party members elected. Is the old ticket voting system, which was wide open for preference harvesting, allowed those micro parties and really small parties to get elected. But it's been much more difficult under the new system since. And as a result, we've seen the vote go back to the major parties, and the more significant to the minor parties have still been able to get elected. But the people who haven't been able to get elected are the ones on only 1% of the vote. Now, this is a slightly more complex table, and I'll explain what this means. Under full preferential voting, at the end of the count, everybody will have a full quota. But under optional preferential voting, as is proposed for the Senate, the last seats are likely to be filled with less than a quota. The preferences will run out on the ballot paper. The first four or five seats will be elected on the first count. The last one, and sometimes two, will require preferences, with the probability the last seat will have less than a quota of votes. This deals with the 21 vacancies since New South Wales has used the new system. In 95 and 99, there were 15 members elected on the first count from filled quotas, and since 2003, there have been 17. Key thing is this column here, the numbers that reached a quota. In 1995, there were four candidates reached a quota after the distribution of preferences. That would actually become six because, for technical reasons, when there were three candidates left at the end of the count and only two to elect, they just excluded the last person, but they didn't distribute them. So, in fact, the last two candidates were elected with less than a quota. If they had distributed the last candidate, the last ones would have been elected with a quota, which is what this number here is in brackets. So I'm saying that in 95 and 99, the last six vacancies were someone who started with less than a quota and reached the quota on preferences. Since the new system was introduced, the last four seats in 2003, the last two in 2007, and the last four in 2011 were elected with less than a quota. There weren't enough preferences around to get that last person through to the quota. So that was the big change that occurred with the change in the system in New South Wales, is instead of people reaching a quota because of preferences, the preferences to a large extent exhaust, and the last candidates get elected with less than a quota. And I've tried to deal with this. This is horribly complex, and I'm sorry about this, but this is the way it works. In 1995, the last six parties that were elected are listed there on the left, and the order they were at the start of the count. The Greens were one, Labor two, Democrats three. When I say Labor, that's the last person on their ticket. Christian Democrats four, the Shooters were fifth, and a party called A Better Future for Our Children was 10th with 0.28 of a quota. It was about 1.3% of the vote. By the end of the count, Better Future for Our Children was the first elected of those parties. Their 0.28 of a quota became 1.12 by the time they were elected. So they got 0.84 of a quota as preferences. So that it wasn't one of the ticket harvestings we've seen since, but everybody else who was excluded on the ballot paper liked A Better Future for Our Children. Who wouldn't like A Better Future for Our Children? And gave him preferences. And he surfed to victory over the top of everybody else. And Shooters Party also got lots of preferences and were the second elected from all those six parties. The Christian Democrats third. I've actually got the order one twice there. I might have mistaken there. But the point I'm making is the order they were at the end on the first preferences was changed by the preferences. And several of these parties got well over half a quota of their quota as preferences. 1999 with the giant ballot paper was an even more spectacular example of that. Down the bottom there is the Outdoor Recreation Party. They finished 29th on first preferences. But of those six micro-parties, they were the first elected. They turned 0.2% of the vote, 0.05 of a quota, into 1.16 quotas by collecting the preferences from 24 different parties. This was the party that was arranged by Glenn Drury, one of the many parties on that ballot paper at that election. And Malcolm Jones was the member. It's a funny story because Glenn Drury was supposed to be elected. But one of his parties, the Marijuana Smokers' Rights Party, got too many votes because it was at the top left of the ballot paper. And he got knocked out, and it resulted in Malcolm Jones of the Outdoor Recreation Party being elected. And I'll just take a slight break here to explain some of the oddities of that process. Because Mr. Drury organised a lot of parties, many of which were organised by four-wheel drive activists. And they had very interesting names. So the Marijuana Smokers' Rights Party, for instance, had its preferences flow to Glenn Drury and then the Outdoor Recreation Party. But of the people who voted that party below the line, 41% went to the Greens and 12% to the Democrats. So very different from people who voted for the party below the line compared to what the registered ticket was. My personal favourite was the Gay and Lesbian Party, which consisted entirely of four-wheel drive activists. I don't think they had any gay and lesbian members at all. All the gay rights activists registered another party called Stop Banks Exploiting Australians, but that's another story. But the Gay and Lesbian Party had their preferences to Glen Drury than the Outdoor Recreation Party. But unsurprisingly, below the line, 33% of the preferences went to the Greens, 29% to the Democrats, and 12% to the Labor Party. Animal Liberation gave their preferences directly to the Outdoor Recreation Party, they were one of that bundle of parties, but 44% of their below-the-line votes went to the Greens. The Marine Environment Conservation Party gave preferences to the Outdoor Recreation Party, another one of these parts of these deals of preference swappings that were going on. But 59% of their preferences below-the-line went to the Greens. The Wilderness Party, 50% below-the-line of the Greens, above the lines of Glen Drury and the Outdoor Recreation Party. The Women's Party Save the Forest, the joint ticket, gave their preference to the Drury and the Outdoor Recreation Party. Their below the lines went 48% to the Greens, 12% to the Democrats. So all those parties with these funny names, which were all associated with this getting the Outdoor Recreation Party or Glen Drury elected, many of them had these names which sounded like left-wing causes or environmental causes, and there were nothing of the sort. Now, we haven't seen that level of confusing of the voters at the federal level, but we have seen parties engaging in funny preference swaps. But that's how the Outdoor Recreation Party turned 0.05 of a quota into 1.16. And this last column here is the most important, that the Greens got 0.6 of a quota as preferences, that Reform the Legal System got more than a quota of their quota as preferences, the Unity Party got 0.8 of a quota as preferences, and the Outdoor Recreation got almost all of their votes as preferences. So that the ticket harvesting system, that preferencing system, which we've since seen in the Senate, allowed people to take a very low vote and turn it into a quota. Well, how's the new system worked? Well, this was the first election where it happened. 1-5, the order there of the last four vacancies, the Greens, Christian Democrats, Labour and the Shooters, Pauline Hanson 5th, and that was the order they were at the end of the camp. But over here in this column where I've got the change between their first preference votes and the, quote, votes after preferences, the biggest change they got after preference was the addition of 0.1 of a quota. So the preferences suddenly became unimportant. You weren't going to change the order of the count with preferences. You could get a little bit of a boost from the preferences if you were slightly behind, but nobody was suddenly going to get elected entirely on preferences. And that's what happened in 2003. In 2007, exactly the same for the four parties at the start were the four parties that got elected and the Democrats missed out. And again, nobody got more than 0.1 of a quota as preferences. And in 2011, I mean, I started to describe this system as a list proportional representation with the highest remainder method of allocating the final vacancy, which is a form of proportional representation used in Europe. This system started to look like that because preferences were suddenly unimportant. And then in 2011, of the final vacancies, Pauline Hanson was third, but she was overtaken by the Greens and the Liberals and Nationals at the last count and missed out on the final seat. But still, the Greens have got 0.13 of an addition from the preferences. Again, that was a very small number. So the system behaved completely differently, where before, under the old system, the system we still use in the Senate, the final vacancies were largely determined by preferences. A candidate come from way behind and get elected on preferences. Since then, it's very much harder for somebody to use preferences to get elected. They have to get votes. And if they want to influence voters, they have to actually hand out harder votes as well. The exhaustion rates under the new system have been enormous in New South Wales. A little bit under 85% at all three elections has been used. So of all the, at the end of the count, when all the last tickets are excluded and only a few groups remain, the exhaustion rate is about 85%, so there's only about 15% of preferences. There are some technical ways you can deal with the way surpluses are calculated, which I can answer in questions if you're interested, which might ensure there are more preferences available. But if those rates flowed through the federal election, it would be very interesting to see how some of the results would work out if there was no clear leader on first preferences on the initial count for the final vacancy. But I would stress that those overall preferences do not at any stage include the exclusion of the Christian Democrats, the Shooters Party, or the Greens. And those three parties, when you look at the actual ballot paper data, have had a greater tendency to be able to sort of influence preferences with harder votes. Now, what we've seen with the How to Votes is the parties publish these How to Votes under the new system, a lower house vote and an upper house vote, and I'll just focus here on the upper house vote. This was the Liberal How to Vote at the last election, which went Group A, Liberals and Nationals, and then recommended a second preference for Group F. Now, not many people have been following these recommendations, so it's clear the ballot papers haven't been very good at encouraging people to follow. The How to Votes haven't been very good at encouraging people to use these preferences. But clearly this will be, under the new system, if parties want to influence their preferences, they're going to have to pay more attention to how this goes and how they influence preferences. Now, I've lost the heading on this, but this shows the breakup of the ballot papers at the 2011 ballot paper, and explain across the top there. There's a percentage vote column. Sattle means single above the line votes, so that people voted just one for a single group above the line. Rattle, random above the line votes, where people have gone one, two, three, and they all have to be data entered. And the final column's below the lines. Now, the interesting thing here is that some of the parties have been encouraging people to vote with preferences above the line. The Christian Democrats, 29.8% of their votes percent at the last election were people going 1, 2, etc. above the line. The Socialists, the Lions, get 28%. Now, they've just got a hardcore activist base who know that they should do something. I think there's a clear differentiation between parties who have got a clear base, like the Christian Democrats, Socialist Alliance, to some extent the Shooters, that they are in contact with. And those voters seem to have a bit more knowledge of what to do with their preferences. The major parties, the Labour Party had only 10% of people distribute preferences above the line. As far as we understand, the Labour Party only issued a Just Vote One How to Vote card for the upper house. Why I say it's unclear is because while New South Wales has registered How to Vote cards since 1988, since 2007 it's been illegal to actually look at them. So they're all registered with the Electoral Commission, but they're kept secret. And you can only inspect the How to Vote cards in your division on polling day between 8 in the morning and 6 at night in the divisional office. It's called minimal access. They said the Elected Labor Party, when they passed the amendment, they said they were legislating to allow people to look at this material, but in fact, except for between 8 and 6 on polling day in the division and only for your division, you can't look at the material. So it's been rather difficult to work out what's been registered ever since. I used to go in and look at this before 2007, so I've got some research here on 2003 in a minute, which I'll display, which I did back then, but I haven't been able to replicate it since because you can't access the How to Votes anymore. So the key thing to state there is the major parties haven't really been encouraging people to use the system, and people haven't been following the How to Vote cards. This is the research I did in 2003, and this is a little more interesting. I'll get my notes. The Liberal Party issued a How to Vote card recommending preferences, but only just under 10% of people actually did preferences above the line. And those that did, actually, they got 40% of people to do what the How to Vote card said, which was give a second preference to the Christian Democrats. So those people they did encourage to give a How to Vote a preference above the line, they actually did follow what the Liberal Party recommended. In fact, if you just looked... So roughly half of their voters went one Liberal, two Christian Democrats, and some people went on to do other matters beyond that, which is not a particularly high take-up rate, but that was the first election this system had been used for, and most people are used to using the Senate where they just vote one. So unless the party really actively on the How to Vote card really encourages preferences, people don't pick it up. The Shooters Party did encourage people to give preferences, and they had a rather complex How to Vote card. They only got 2% of the vote. 26% of their supporters exactly followed the How to Vote card, which had five preferences. So it was a rather complex How to Vote card. Although they had a higher rate of nearly 47% of Shooters voters gave preferences to a party, which was a joint ticket of the fishing party, horse riding party, four-wheel drive party. They were in one of the advantages of the new system was it encouraged these sorts of groups. Like you've got a Shooters party, a fishing party, a horse riders party, and a four-wheel drive party. You'd imagine they've got a bit of commonality on what they're standing for. Under the new system, it's likely that those sorts of parties would be encouraged to combine because there's no point running separate tickets if you can't control preferences. But there was a fair flow on a Shooters Party's preferences to these other parties, and to some extent it's because the Shooters Party have a membership base which is based around Shooters clubs. So they actually get post material to them about how to vote. They don't just rely on how to vote cards. The Labor Party issued two types of how to vote cards. In half of the electorates, they had a how to vote card that went one Labor, two Green, and in the other half of the electorates, they had a how to vote card that went one Labor, two Unity. And they got 25% of their voters to follow that, give preferences above the line, and 77% of them did one of those two options. So they either went one Labor, two Unity, or one Labor, two Green. So that was a really strong flow of preferences. I haven't got a sample of what the how to vote card looked like in 2003, but clearly it must have had a good design if lots of people did that. Though still, only a quarter of their voters actually bothered to use the new system. To some extent, I thought that is also partly to do with people are used to just voting one. I think one of the consequences of this, if you're talking about the Senate, there's got to be thought into what the ballot paper looks like to avoid something like that ballot paper, and so that people have clearer instructions on their options. The Democrats got very few people to follow their how to vote cards, I suspect because very few people handed them out, actually received them. Plus, they had a very complex how to vote card which had six preferences on it. And if you're not handing out how to vote cards and your how to vote card has six preferences on it, then you've got a pretty random chance that anybody's actually going to by accident produce that preference sequence. But of the people who did give preferences above the line, 43% went to the Greens as their second preference. So clearly the Democrats' voters, about one in five who did use the system, had an idea what to do with their preferences next. Unity also had something. And the interesting thing with Unity do not do a lot of how-to-vote material. And for a party that gets a very low vote, they've always had very strong flows of preferences because they worked largely within the Chinese community. There's a lot of advertising in the Chinese press and through Chinese community groups. And I have the suspicion a lot of people get something given to them before they turn up at the polling place. And that's why they seem to get quite strong flows. Of their preferences, 20% voted with preferences above line, but only 17 followed again a rather complex how-to-vote card. But when you looked at their people, what people did fill in, 50% went to the Labor Party, which wasn't what the how-to-vote said. So either people were making up their own mind, or there was something other than the registered how-to-vote card floating around which people were using as a cue. It's impossible to know. I mean, one of the difficulties of doing this sort of research is you don't know what people received on the day. The Socialist Alliance, which always fascinates me, the sheer number of people for such a tiny vote who actually know the system, they got a very high rate of 30% giving preferences. Not many followed the how-to-vote card, but those that did make up their own mind went 67% to the Greens. So there's clearly a perception amongst that party of an affinity party for them. And with some of these parties, you see that quite constantly. Even if there isn't a how-to-vote card, there's a constant flow of preferences of a certain type. The Greens had 26%, roughly a quarter of their voters, gave preferences above line. They had a complex how-to-vote card with six preferences, and only 18% of people actually followed it. Again, it was a complex preference flow. People made up their own mind, you suspect. If you looked at how people did give preferences, a third of them gave preferences to Labour, which was not what the how-to-vote said. So, again, you're seeing a lot of people making up their own mind, whether because they didn't get a how-to-vote card or not, I'm not sure. And the Christian Democrats are the most interesting example, because they have consistently had the highest proportion of people directing preferences, and they've consistently had a how-to-vote card which went one Christian Democrat, two for the Liberal Party, and they get 35% of people doing that exactly. Now, in fact, their preference flow is, in fact, higher because there were, in fact, 75% of people went two for the Liberal Democrats. Actually, no, I'm slightly wrong there. Their how-to-vote card in 2003 went two Liberal, three shooters, and only 35% of people did that. But fully 75% of people who gave preferences above the line went one Christian Democrats, two Liberal. So they clearly used the system. And what we see in this sort of area is some of these minor parties who are organised, like the Christian Democrats, Family First, have a better record of people giving preferences below the line when they fill it, which are not like their ticket votes. Now, going to this, this is some research I did on the 2013 Senate election. And the interesting thing there was there were 18 parties that directed preferences to the sports party and delivered 100% of their vote to the sports party. But of all those people, all those parties, 18 parties, those who voted below the line, only 13% delivered preferences to the sports party. And to show this a problem of how preference harvesting has been used, this is for each of these parties that gave preferences to the above the line to the sports party, what their below the lines looked like. So the Christians, Australian Christians, 55% of their below the line preferences went to the Liberals, but their ticket went to the Sports Party. Family First, 40% to Liberal. Rise Up Australia, 39% to the Liberals. The Democrats, 52% to the Greens. Animal Justice, 53% to the Greens. WikiLeaks to the Greens. Australian Independence to the Greens. Sex Party to the Greens. Hemp to the Greens. Stable Population Party to the Greens. All those parties, voters who voted for them had a perception of a party which is like them. And if they voted below the line, they gave their preferences in a way. If you know those parties and the names of those parties or the organisation of those parties, that's where you would expect their preferences to go. But the tickets went to the Sports Party and elected Wayne Dropulich on that first count. And that's where the current system has been wrong. And the option that's available, which you've got preferences for everybody below the line, is not used by people because it's too complex, too difficult. People vote one above the line, and then these preference arrangements are going to go. And this is where the new system will undo that sort of arrangements. These sorts of preference deals will disappear if a party wants to elect itself, or if it doesn't elect itself, it wants to influence members, then it will have to hand out how-to-vote cards and talk to its members and get this information out to the public. So, if you applied what I've seen in New South Wales to the last federal election, and this is my final slide, this is very speculative because, of course, with so many candidates and so many parties on the ballot paper, under the new system, those numbers would substantially diminish, as we've seen in New South Wales. If there are four different strands of outdoor recreation activism as parties, they might as well amalgamate under the new system because there's no advantage being separate anymore. If there's four different shades of Christian parties around, morals parties, it's in their interest to merge under the new system to get their first preference vote up. So there's an urge to merge which comes with the new system, which will make this sort of analysis is very tentative. But if the new system had been in place, then you would have seen the Liberals would have won the last spot in Victoria, not the Motorist Party. That Labor would probably have got two seats, and Nick Xenophon would probably have got two seats in South Australia at the expense of the Greens and the Family First, who relied much more on preferences to win. And that the Palmer United Sports Party ticket in WA would more likely have been a second Labor candidate. Those were the cases where there was someone elected essentially on preferences as opposed to elected on first preference. However, it has to be said, with fewer candidates on the ballot paper, voters would pay more attention to the votes, the candidates that are there. If you've only got 12 columns on a ballot paper and it's in 10-point type, you're more likely to read it than 110 candidates in 6-point. And clearly in New South Wales, the sheer size of the ballot paper interfered with people's choices. So I suspect that there would have been a different split up of the first preferences under the new system. Some of that vote which was sprayed across the ballot paper would have gone back to major parties. I also have the suspicion that Palmer United would have polled more strongly on the first preferences because people would have seen it on the ballot paper. One of the biggest problems with giant ballot papers is people do not read the ballot paper. They turn up looking for, in New South Wales, the Liberal Party. They start to read the ballot paper and they see Liberal Democrats in the first column and get confused. People don't read all the options available. And when you do research on these ballot papers, you can always see examples where, in particularly that case in New South Wales, a clear bias towards the top left-hand side of the ballot paper compared to the bottom right-hand side of the ballot paper, and that's a pretty consistent thing. Anyway, I've been through a lot of material there, and I'm quite happy to take questions on it and give some general opinions. I'll just leave that up there for the moment, but I'm happy to take questions from anybody on the subject.
Any questions from the audience? We have one over here.
Hello. I've got a question just sort of technically. You'd mentioned about the preference minimum being 6 in the potential of the new Senate system. Does that apply to the territory Senate votes as well? Or
it
how
would be,
does it work?
The idea is to put the number of vacancies, 1 to 6, 1 to 2, 1 to 12 for a double dissolution. I stress strongly that they should ensure that the formality criteria be as liberal as possible. One of the problems in New South Wales is Pauline Hanson has been severely disadvantaged because she has no party name. She appears on the ballot paper. People come in. There's this blank box above the line. And underneath the line, you see Pauline Hanson. And people come in and just go one next to Pauline Hanson. And every one of those votes is informal. Under the new system, if someone just comes in there and votes one for the lead candidate on a ticket, it will be informal. Given that nearly all of the votes are straight down the ticket anyway, I would hate to see those sorts of votes struck out as informal when they could be left in the count and just weighted out in the surplus formula. So I'm encouraging the Commission and the Committee to make the criteria, the formality criteria, as liberal as possible. So if someone mucks up going from 1 to 6, the vote should still count. I don't think we want to go down to the system of trying to make it easier to vote but ending up by accident increasing the informality rate. As I always say, I think that one of the problems with formality rules in Australia is there are too many rules defining what can't count rather than rules defining what can count. And if someone just doesn't have enough numbers on the ballot paper, I don't see why it should be cut out. But it would be 1 to 6 at a half Senate election, 1 to 2 in the territories, or 1 to 12 at a double dissolution, but with a very liberal formality criteria.
Any other questions? While people are thinking, the Parliamentary Committee and the model you talked about, any sense of how that's been received and by the parties and the commentators?
I think it's generally been conceived as a good idea. The idea of quotas had a slight constitutional problem, a potential constitutional problem, but also had unforeseen consequences. If you kept ticket voting and you introduce some sort of threshold quota on first preferences, you have the potential problem there, you're just making the ticket harvesting tactic different. And what level should you set the quota at? You would imagine that if you just put in a threshold, you would set a party like the Palmer United Party, which might get above the threshold, would then potentially harvest every sort of little micro-party on the ballot paper because they're not one of the major parties. I think the perception I got from most of the bigger parties in relation to the last election is they were thoroughly tired of talking to people in, you know, nobody's ever heard of who have a party registered. But if they can get 0.1% of the vote and they can control it as a ticket, they've got something they can give you. And so you have to talk to them. If under the new system there were no preference tickets and someone's got 0.1% of the vote, then you can just ignore them. They haven't got something to trade with you. Under the current system, what the system encouraged was game playing. And the classic example of this was 2004 in Victoria when the Labor Party was in competition for its third senator against the first Green. And so it was the interest of both of those parties to do side deals, to try and increase their first preference vote, to increase their chances of getting elected. So the Labor Party got involved in that game process. It did deals with micro-parties to try and increase the chances of its third candidate staying ahead of the Green. But in doing that, they gave up their ability to control their preferences if they were excluded. They might have preferred if they didn't get three up to elect the Green. But by doing these preference deals to elect themselves, they gave up their ability to elect the Green because they'd given the preference to Family First. So Family First got elected. So the parties, the ticket voting system, encouraged people to engage in strategic preference deals. The Senate voting system has underpinning it the idea that voters are revealing their preferences. They are numbering the ballot paper in the order they want to see the candidates elected. They're not arranging some sort of strategic preference deal. Because if you as an individual try to determine what order the candidates finish, you've got no hope of knowing that. So the best strategy for any individual is to fill in the ballot paper in the order you want to see the candidates elected. And all the rules for counting the votes assume that that's the way everybody's filled in the ballot paper. But ticket voting completely undermines that assumption. Because as the Labor Party did at that election, they didn't do preferences in a way so that they wanted the candidates elected. They did it in a strategic way to try and maximise their chance of getting elected, an extra member elected. So that's what's wrong with the current system. It actually undermines the principles of the counting method by doing that. And most parties at some stage have engaged in that. I mean, in Western Australia and South Australia, the Greens got a little bit involved in that, again, to maximise their chance because they were competing with Labor for the last spot. That becomes less of a problem under the new system because there will be very few preferences floating around. They will actually be competing with each other on votes. The coalition will be competing with Labor and the Greens on votes. Any micro party or minor party who wants to get involved will have to get votes if they want to get elected. And if you've got some of the parties like Family First or the Christian Democrats want to influence the final position on preferences, one, they have to campaign to get votes, and two, they have to campaign to influence their preferences. So I forgot where that question started because I got it. But I mean, I think the system is, I think this system becomes a much better system because it forces the system to work on votes and on real preferences, not invented preferences, which are created by the fact you have to number every box, and also preferences based on the idea that parties are engaged in strategic preference deals.
I was just wondering about the system in terms of, like in WA, we had to have the half Senate again because 1,000 votes went missing. Is this more robust because it seems like 1,000 missing votes is less, it's harder to argue that that would change the outcome?
Well, that's exactly the point. The problem in WA was that the 9th and 10th placed candidates, who both had 1.75% of the vote, were separated by on one count 14, on another 12, and on a third one vote. So two candidates in 9th and 10th place were competing for spot, and depending on which order they got knocked out, they sent the preferences off at tangents. So that those that tiny vote between two candidates who had no chance of getting elected determined whether on one route the Greens and Clive Palmer got elected. Labour and Clive Palmer got elected, or if it went the other way, whether the Greens and the Sports Party got elected. So here was this ridiculous count very early on that was critical to the final outcome. Now, I can point to lower house electorates where you get the situation where the candidate finished third determines who finishes first and second. But to determine the last two spots based on who finishes ninth and tenth is ridiculously overdeterministic. The system shouldn't be that prescriptive from very low on. If in an election where voters had to give their preferences, a candidate only got 1.75% of the vote, their preferences would be essentially random because there wouldn't be any strong flows. As I was showing on, was it this slide? Where people gave their own preferences, with the best you got was 50% flows for some of these parties like the Australian Christians, Family First. If you look at some of those other smaller parties that aren't on that list, all stable population, they were down about 37%. If you talk about the various sporting parties, their preference flows were at best 12 or 13% to one party. The preference flows are essentially random if they're that low. If they're polling so badly that that's all the vote they got, then they had no idea how their preferences should be distributed and they're essentially random. That's how the new system would work. And of course, with those low votes, a lot of them will just exhaust, and in which case they don't flow anyway. So the system would be more robust because those candidates that finished 9th and 10th, the issue was there. If you've got to remember Mr. Dropulich, three times in that count, he dropped a second last in the count and was saved and carried on. Under a system where voters gave their own preferences, he wouldn't have been saved from that second last finish. He would have fallen to last at the next count. And that's the same there, is that those situations, those candidates finishing 9th and 10th, would have been excluded 9th and 10th in whatever order they finished. Where under the current system, what happened was, because the candidate finished 9th, they suddenly leapt to 7th or 8th. That wouldn't happen under the new system. Therefore, the system would be more robust. And the sheer difficulty the Electoral Commission had created by 1,000 missing votes would have been far less critical. If the last spot between the two last candidates had come down to 100 votes, and yet there's 1,000 missing votes, then it might have been close, but not the situation where we had, where it was two candidates very early in the count determining the last two seats.
Tony, last question.
In your urge to merge, that could take off, how would the parties determine their order of their order to be elected? If you've got three particularly strong identities who bring their parties together and form a merged group, presumably in a below-the-line scenario, the person with the most votes gets elected.
Well, it is. Yeah, one of the difficulties it has always struck me with some of these fractional parties, several strands of Christian morals parties, or the several strands of outdoor activism parties, there has been a tendency for each of these to have their own chief, and these chiefs don't seem to get on with each other. And so the system, which has allowed them to swap preferences with each other, has permitted them to have their personal differences without actually sort of stopping their collective vote amongst that branch of parties having an influence. They would have to swallow their egos and work out how to get elected. I mean, all the major parties and the Greens have a mechanism to determine the order their candidates appeared. If some of these micro parties merged, they'd have to think seriously about that process.
Presumably, if they didn't switch over a quota and the quota remained the system, the people with the lowest votes would go and whoever got the highest vote. If they ended up over a quota, then they'd have to have a very serious conversation.
Well, it mean they'd have to decide, you know, if let's say, look, there are the last election there were the Christian Democrats in New South Wales, the Australian Christians in every other state, Family First and Rise Up Australia, who have some significant overlap. And each of them has their own particular strong leaders within the parties. I mean, if there is vote there for a Christian conservative vote, if you could amalgamate those parties together, you would get 2, 3, 4, 5% of the vote. But there would have to be some accommodation between the different egos that run their own factional modes. You look at the same, you've got the Outdoor Recreation Party, you've got the Fishing and Lifestyle Party, and you've got the Shooters and the Fishers Party, and you've got the Four Wheel Drive Party, and there's a number of these. And then you've got the alternative, which is actually the Outdoor Recreation Party, the Liberal Democrats and the Smokers' Rights Association, which seem to have no difficulty agreeing on who should be the one candidate, but they seem to have separate parties. There's a number of different ways that the system is gamed with running multiple parties, and Mr. Lionhelm, in the evidence before the Joint Standing Committee on Electoral Matters, suggested that if he'd had time, he would have set up 20 different parties, all with different goals directed to the Liberal Democrats as a way of working the system. Well, I don't think that's an acceptable way to run an electoral system. Elections, in the end, and I know there's a party called the Carers Alliance who often campaign just to get their cause on the ballot paper. That's fine, but elections are also not about just publicising a cause. They're also about electing representatives to Parliament. Mr. Muir, for instance, from Victoria, there were 13 or 14, I think about 15 parties contributed to him getting elected. Which party does he represent? Does he represent the Motorist Party? Does he represent all the parties that gave him preferences? Does he represent different parties on different days? I don't know. That's one of the problems of the preferential system. At least under the new system, if a micro-party did get 5% and get elected, which is possible, they at least know the 5% that elected them. Whereas under the current system, who does elect some of these members and who are they responsible to? And does a system which to some extent is based on randomness of preferences, strange deals in the background, and confusion on names, confusing voters on names, is that the best way to elect a Senate? The Senate is a very important chamber. It was given very significant powers in 1901 by the Constitution. It is the most powerfully elected, one of the most powerful upper houses in the world. And we're using an electoral system which has people manipulating a ballot paper long in a font they can't read, full of candidates they don't know, to determine this powerful upper house. And it's a bit of a joke. And we need an electoral system which more rationally and sensibly reflects the will of the electorate and who gets elected out of the system. Today, we haven't had the New South Wales abuses because the quota is three times as large. But as we saw at this year's election, unless something's done about it, we do get oddities where people you've never heard of get elected and get an important say in the balance of power.
Thank you. Now, the eagle-eyed among you may have noticed that there's a camera recording this, so if you are moved to watch the whole thing again, you can. I'd invite you to join me in thanking Anthony for that excellent speech.
I will say I'll try and get some of these tables written up on my blog off next week if you want to have a look at them.
Thank you.
Interesting. Good day, Anthony. Oh, hang on. Hey. Where's he going?
I'm
not thinking conspiracy. I'm not thinking conspiracy.